He hands them to me in an old cigar box. We take turns throwing them at the target. Neither of us is very good, and I bury one in the wall. Petra's laugh is dark and liquid. My aim has never been good, I confess. When I was a kid, we used to have a beanbag toss game that my aunt bought us, and I literally never once got a beanbag into the hole, not a single time. We're talking literally years of my life. My brother thought it was the goddamn funniest thing he'd ever seen. Petra stares at me. A handsome smile pulls at the edge of her mouth, and then vanishes, replaced by a flattened expression. Then she says, "Your family sounds really fucking nice." The word nice is like a splinter of glass. I have been picking up my phone every few days, intending to explain to my family that women are sewn into dresses, and I'm working at a factory and I'm living in a hotel with the daughter of a seamstress who is also dying, though not exactly dying. I can't. The last time I talked to my mother, I assured her I was solid and safe, though I confessed to her that I'd had to delay my student loan payments again. I made up stories about the day's clients, and it must have been believable because she sounded relieved. "They are," I say. "Maybe you'll get to meet them one day." "I wouldn't bother. I'm on the way out, right?" "Jesus fuck, Petra. Don't talk like that. And don't talk to me like that." She falls into a sullen silence, absently picks at a zit on her chin. She finishes her beer, buys another. Her dart toss is becoming less precise, yawning wider and wider from the center target. I don't like the way she is pulling the darts out of the board, like she's yanking on an opponent's ponytail. After the fourth game, her hand blinks out mid-drink, and the glass falls, beer and shards of glass asterisking on the wooden floorboards. Petra walks over to the board. I can see her opening and closing her fist, feeling for substance. In the moment that matter returns to her, she rests her hand flat and palm down on the wall. Pulling the dart from the target, she plunges it deep into the back of her hand, just below the knuckles. From the back of the bar, someone yells, "Holy shit!" I crash past the table and grab Petra, though not before she has plunged the needle of the dart into her hand twice more. She is screaming. Blood streams down her arm like maypole ribbons. Men get up quickly from their stools and chairs, some of which clatter to the floor. Petra flails, howling. Her blood spatters the wall like rain. A stocky man in a black baseball cap helps me drag her out the front door. I half-carry, half-haul her across the icy parking lot. After we have gone a few dozen yards, she seems to soften in my arms. For a moment, I am terrified she is fading again. But no, she is still solid, just limp with exhaustion and stubbornness. A dark trail marks the path we have taken. She refuses the hospital. In our room, I disinfect her wound, wrap it in gauze. We have never fucked with such urgency as we do in these weeks. But she is fading more and feeling less. She comes infrequently. She withdraws for longer and longer periods of time. 1 minute, 4, 7. Each episode shows a different view of her. A skeleton, ropey muscles, the dark shapes of her organs. Nothing. She wakes up sobbing, and I rope my arm tightly around her torso, shushing gently into her ear. She reads rumors on the internet about how you can slow fading. One message board talks about a high iron diet, so she steams enough spinach to feed a large family and chews on it wordlessly. Another recommends ice-cold showers, and I find her trembling and goosebumped in the bathtub. She lets me dry her off, like she's a child. On a warm Sunday, Petra wants to go for a hike, so we do. Spring seizes the valley in fits and spurts, and today the paths through the woods are muddy. Snow melts and drips water into our hair. We follow a creek that is practically a living thing, surging messily through its own curves and bends. We take a break in a sunny clearing and eat oranges and cold chicken. Petra has taken to treating every meal as her last, so she peels the skins off the pieces of chicken and chews on them with her eyes closed, and then on the meat itself, and then she sucks hard on every bone before throwing it off into the trees. She sets each wedge of orange in her mouth reverently, as if it is the Eucharist, bites into the meat, and pulls the rinds away like hangnails. She rubs the peels against her skin. "I've been doing some reading," says Petra in between pulls of ice water. "It turns out that they think the fated women are doing this sort of, I don't know, I guess you'd call it terrorism. They're getting themselves into electrical systems and fucking up servers and ATMs and voting machines, protesting." She still refers to them in the third person. "I like that." The woods are quiet, but for the hum of insects and twittering of birds. We peel off our clothes and soak in the sun. I examine my fingertips against the light, pink amber halos around the shadows of my bones. I lean over Petra and kiss her bottom lip, the top. I kiss her throat. I bury my hand between her thighs. Around us, minutes inch over the dirt like ants, tumble into the swollen stream, and are carried away. We find a chapel among the trees. The pews are even and rigid, and stained glass windows line the walls. Our footfalls echo along the stone floor. The air is hot, and we kick up dust that weaves through the light. We sit down in a pew that groans beneath our weight. Petra lays her head on my shoulder. "Do you think the fated women ever die?" "I guess I don't know." "Or age?" I shrug and press my nose into her hair. "I might be 29 for all of eternity." "Maybe. You'll be haunting me when I'm 100, and you'll look fantastic and I'll look like shit." "Nah, you'll be a beautiful crone. You'll have a cabin in the forest, and there will be rumors that you're a witch. But the kids who are brave enough to get close will get to listen to your stories." She shudders so hard I feel it in my skeleton. I see movement out of the corner of my eye and I stand. In the window depicting St. Rita of Cassia, a faded woman is clinging to the lead, her fingers curled around the canes as if they were monkey bars. She is watching us, rocking on her heels, popping in and out of the glass as if she were treading water. Petra notices her and stands next to me. In her hand, I see the votive of a prayer candle. "Petra, don't." I can see her throw muscles twitching. "I can set her free," she says. "If I break it, I can set her free." "We don't know that. Don't tell me what to do. You're not my fucking mother." I gently circle her wrist and lean into her hair. "I love you," I say. It's the first time I've said it, and it tastes strange in my mouth, real but not ready, like a too hard pear. I ease the votive from her hand and slide it into my jacket pocket. I kiss her temple, her jaw. She turns into my body. I think she's going to cry, but she doesn't. "I miss you already," she says. I run my hand along her back, and as I do, I am certain I see a flash of my own muscle. My stomach tightens. The chicken and oranges protest, press up my esophagus. "We should go back," I say. "I think it's going to be dark soon." The fated woman won't look away. She smiles, or maybe she is grimacing. We come out of the woods like we are being born. In our room, we watch the news, our bodies curled together in the soft blue glow of the television. Pundits point fingers at each other, screaming as the co-host between them shimmers and wavers under the studio lights. They are talking about how we can't trust the fated women. Women who can't be touched, but can stand on the earth. Which means they must be lying about something. They must be deceiving us somehow. I don't trust anything that can be incorporeal and isn't dead, one of them says. The woman blinks away mid-broadcast, a microphone tumbling to the floor. The camera scrambles to look away. Before we go to bed, I set the votive from the chapel on the nightstand and light the candle. It flickers comfortingly, casting the furniture against the wall like shadow puppets. I dream that we go to a restaurant that serves only soup. I can't decide what to order, and she laughs and stirs the bowl she's already received. When she pulls the spoon out, there is a jellied, ghostly hand twirled tightly around the handle, and she pulls the fated woman up and up. The woman's mouth is open, as if she's crying out, but I can't hear anything. When I wake, I am sure Petra has gone for a run, before I realize that my hand has sunk into the luminous cavern of her chest. I tip into her completely, choke like I'm being waterboarded. She wakes up and screams as I flail around inside her. After a minute, we calm down. She moves away from me to the edge of the bed. We wait. 7 minutes go by. 10. Half an hour. Is this it? I ask her. Is this it? I don't want to leave, but she has turned away from me. I stand up. She does not look at anything except her own hands. After a long time, she says, "It's time to go." I cry. I slip on my boots, their heels chewed up by my uneven footsteps. I look at her there, gone. And she finally turns, and I know she can see my body, still solid enough to be limbed in light, moving about the watery afterbirth of the sunrise. I close the door behind me, and I feel my nerves fire on and off. Soon I'll be nothing more, too. None of us will make it to the end. Only half of the mannequins in Glam's windows are clothed. It's the end of the season. The shop will rotate soon. The stock will go somewhere. The lights go out. The gate rattles down halfway. Natalie stoops beneath it and pulls it shut. She stands up and sees me. She looks thinner than I remember. She nods ever so slightly and then takes off into the cavernous interior of the mall. I hold my old key tightly in my hand. It fits the lock. Gizzy never bothered to change it. The gate slides up loudly. The pinking shears are stuck in the back of my jeans, where I could carry a gun if I cared to. I cut the places where one thing is stitched to another. I unlace bodices. I can see them, the women, loosened from their moorings, blinking up at me. "Get out," I tell them. I tear at the hems and seams. The dresses are coming apart, looking more alive than I have ever seen them, the fabric splitting away from the form like so many banana peels, flaps of gold and peach and wine. "Get out," I say again. They are blinking, unmoving. "Why aren't you going?" I scream. "Say something!" They do not. I pull away the panel of a bodice. A woman stares back at me. She could be Gizzy's daughter. She could be Petra or Natalie or my mother or even me. "No, fuck it. You don't even have to say anything. Just get out. The gate is open, please." A flashlight beam dances over the far wall. I hear a deep voice. "Hello? Who's there? I've called the police." "Please go!" I scream, even as the security guard tackles me to the ground. From the blackness of the floor, I see them all, faintly luminous, moving about in their husks. But they remain. They don't move. They never move. 8 bites. As they put me to sleep, my mouth fills with the dust of the moon. I expect to choke on the silt, but instead it slides in and out, and in and out, and I am impossibly breathing. I have dreamt of inhaling underneath water, and this is what it feels like. Panic, and then acceptance, and then elation. I am going to die. I am not dying. I am doing a thing I never thought I could do. Back on Earth, Dr. Yu is inside me. Her hands are in my torso, her fingers searching for something. She is loosening flesh from its casing, slipping around where she's been welcomed, talking to a nurse about her vacation to Chile. "We were going to fly to Antarctica," she says, "but it was too expensive." "But the penguins," the nurse says. "Next time," Dr. Yu responds. Before this, it was January, a new year. I waded through 2 feet of snow on a silent street and came to a shop where wind chimes hung silently on the other side of the glass, mermaid-shaped baubles and bits of driftwood, and 2 shiny seashells strung through with fishing line and unruffled by any wind. The town was deep dead, a great distance from the late-season smattering of open shops that served the day-trippers and the money-savers. Owners had fled to Boston or New York, or, if they were lucky, farther south. Businesses had shuttered for the season, leaving their wares in the windows like a tease. Underneath, a second town had opened up, familiar and alien at the same time. It's the same every year. Bars and restaurants made secret hours for locals, the rock-solid Cape Codders who've lived through dozens of winters. On any given night, you could look up from your plate to see round bundles stomp through the doorway. Only when they peeled their outsides away could you see who was beneath. Even the ones you knew from the summer were more or less strangers in this perfunctory daylight. All of them were alone, even when they were with each other. On this street, though, I might as well have been on another planet. The beach bunnies and art dealers would never see the town like this, I thought, when the streets are dark and a liquid chill roils through the gaps and alleys. Silence and sound bumped up against each other, but never intermingled. The jolly chaos of warm summer nights was as far away as it could be. It was hard to stop moving between doorways in this weather, but if you did, you could hear life pricking the stillness. A rumble of voices from a local tavern, wind livening the buildings, sometimes even a muffled animal encounter in an alley. Pleasure or fear, it was all the same noise. Foxes wove through the streets at night. There was a white one among them, sleek and fast, and she looked like the ghost of the others. I was not the first in my family to go through with it. My 3 sisters had gotten a procedure over the years, though they didn't say anything before showing up for a visit. Seeing them suddenly svelte after years of watching them grow organically, as I have, was like a palm to the nose, more painful than you'd expect. My 1st sister, well, I thought she was dying. Being sisters, I thought we all were dying, noosed by genetics. When confronted by my anxiety, "What disease is sawing off this branch of the family tree?" I asked, my voice crab-walking up an octave. My 1st sister confessed, "A surgery." Then all of them, my sisters, a chorus of believers. "Surgery. A surgery. As easy as when you broke your arm as a kid and had to get the pins in, maybe even easier. A band. A sleeve. A gut rerouted." Rerouted? But their stories. It melts away. It's just gone. We're spring morning warm, when the sun makes the difference between happiness and shivering in a shadow. When we went out, they ordered large meals and then said, "I couldn't possibly." They always said this, always, that decorous insistence that they couldn't possibly. But for once, they actually meant it. That bashful lie had been converted into truth vis-a-vis a medical procedure. They angled their forks and cut impossibly tiny portions of food, doll-sized cubes of watermelon, a slender stalk of pea shoot, a corner of a sandwich, as if they needed to feed a crowd, loaves and fishes style, with that single serving of chicken salad, and swallowed them like a great decadence. "I feel so good," they all said. Whenever I talked to them, that was what always came out of their mouths. Or really, it was a mouth, a single mouth that once ate, and now just says, "I feel really, really good." Who knows where we got it from, though? The bodies that needed the surgery? It didn't come from our mother, who always looked normal. Not hardy or curvy or Rubenesque or Midwestern or voluptuous. Just normal. She always said 8 bites are all you need to get the sense of what you are eating. Even though she never counted out loud, I could hear the 8 bites as clearly as if a game show audience were counting backward, raucous and triumphant. And after 1, she would set her fork down, even if there was food left on her plate. She didn't mess around, my mother. No pushing food in circles or pretending. Iron will. Slender waistline. 8 bites let her compliment the hostess. 8 bites lined her stomach, like insulation rolled into the walls of houses. I wished she was still alive, to see the women her daughters had become. And then one day, not too soon after my third sister sashayed out of my house with more spring in her step than I'd ever seen, I ate 8 bites, and then stopped. I set the fork down next to the plate, more roughly than I'd intended, and took a chip of ceramic off the rim in the process. I pressed my finger into the shard and carried it to the trash can. I turned and looked back at my plate, which had been so full before, and was full still, barely a dent in the raucous mass of pasta and greens. I sat down again, picked up my fork, and had 8 more bites. Not much more, still barely a dent, but now twice as much as necessary. But the salad leaves were dripping vinegar and oil, and the noodles had lemon and cracked pepper, and everything was just so beautiful. And I was still hungry. And so I had 8 more. And I finished what was in the pot on the stove, and I was so angry I began to cry. I don't remember getting fat. I wasn't a fat child or teenager. Photos of those young selves are not embarrassing, or if they are, they're embarrassing in the right ways. Look how young I am. Look at my weird fashion. Saddle shoes. Who thought of those? Stirrup pants? Are you joking? Squirrel barrettes? Look at those glasses. Look at that face mugging for the camera. Look at that expression. Mugging for a future self who is holding those photos sick with nostalgia. Even when I thought I was fat, I wasn't. The teenager in those photos is very beautiful, in a wistful kind of way. But then I had a baby. Then I had Cal, difficult, sharp-eyed Cal, who has never gotten me half as much as I have never gotten her. And suddenly everything was wrecked, like she was a heavy metal rocker thrashing a hotel room before departing. My stomach was the television set through the window. She was now a grown woman, and so far away from me in every sense. But the evidence still clung to my body. It would never look right again. As I stood over the empty pot, I was tired. I was tired of the skinny, mini women from church who cooed and touched each other's arms and told me I had beautiful skin. And having to rotate my hips sideways to move through rooms, like crawling over someone at the movie theater. I was tired of flat, unforgiving dressing room lights. I was tired of looking into the mirror and grabbing the things that I hated and lifting them, clawing deep, and then letting them drop, and everything aching. My sisters had gone somewhere else and left me behind, and as I always have, I wanted nothing more than to follow. I could not make 8 bites work for my body, and so I would make my body work for 8 bites. Dr. Yu did twice-a-week consultations in an office a half-hour drive south on the Cape. I took a slow, circuitous route getting there. It had been snowing on and off for days, and the sleepy snowdrifts caught on every tree trunk and fence post like blown-away laundry. I knew the way, because I'd driven past her office before, usually after a sister's departure. And so as I drove this time, I daydreamt about buying clothes in the local boutiques, spending too much for a sundress taken off a mannequin, pulling it against my body in the afternoon sun as the mannequin stood, less lucky than I. Then I was in her office, on her neutral carpet, and a receptionist was pushing open a door. The doctor was not what I expected. I suppose I had imagined that because of the depth of her convictions, as illustrated by her choice of profession, she should have been a slender woman, either someone with excessive self-control, or a sympathetic soul whose insides had also been rearranged to suit her vision of herself. But she was sweetly plump. Why had I skipped over the phase where I was round and unthreatening as a panda, but still lovely? She smiled with all her teeth. What was she doing, sending me on this journey she herself had never taken? She gestured, and I sat. There were 2 Pomeranians running around her office. When they were separated, when one was curled up at Dr. Yu's feet and the other was decorously taking a shit in the hallway, they appeared identical but innocuous. But when one came near the other, they were spooky, their heads twitching in sync, as if they were 2 halves of a whole. The doctor noticed the pile outside of the door and called for the receptionist. The door closed. "I know what you're here for," she said before I could open my mouth. "Have you researched bariatric surgery before?" "Yes," I said. "I want the kind you can't reverse." "I admire a woman of conviction," she said. She began pulling binders out of a drawer. "There are some procedures you'll have to go through. Visiting a psychiatrist, seeing another doctor, support groups, administrative nonsense taking up a lot of time. But everything is going to change for you," she promised, shaking a finger at me with an accusing, loving smile. "It will hurt. It won't be easy. But when it's over, you're going to be the happiest woman alive." My sisters arrived a few days before the surgery. They set themselves up in the house's many empty bedrooms, making up their side tables with lotions and crossword puzzles. I could hear them upstairs, and they sounded like birds, distinct and luminously choral at the same time. I told them I was going out for a final meal. "We'll come with you," said my first sister. "Keep you company," said my second sister. "Be supportive," said my third sister. "No," I said. "I'll go alone. I need to be alone." I walked to my favorite restaurant, Salt. It hadn't always been Salt, though, in name or spirit. It was Linda's for a while, and then Family Diner, then The Table. The building remains the same, but it is always new and always better than before. I thought about people on death row and their final meals as I sat at a corner table, and for the 3rd time that week, I worried about my moral compass, or lack thereof. They aren't the same, I reminded myself, as I unfolded the napkin over my lap. Those things are not comparable. Their last meal comes before death. Mine comes before not just life, but a new life. You are horrible, I thought, as I lifted the menu to my face, higher than it needed to be. I ordered a cavalcade of oysters. Most of them had been cut the way they were supposed to be, and they slipped down as easily as water, like the ocean, like nothing at all. But one fought me, anchored to its shell, a stubborn hinge of flesh. It resisted. It was resistance incarnate. Oysters are alive, I realized. They are nothing but muscle. They have no brains or insides, strictly speaking, but they are alive nonetheless. If there were any justice in the world, this oyster would grab hold of my tongue and choke me dead. I almost gagged, but then I swallowed. My third sister sat down across the table from me. Her dark hair reminded me of my mother's, almost too shiny and homogeneous to be real, though it was. She smiled kindly at me, as if she were about to give me some bad news. "Why are you here?" I asked her. "You looked troubled," she said. She held her hands in a way that showed off her red nails, which were so lacquered they had horizontal depth, like a rose trapped in glass. She tapped them against her cheekbones, scraping them down her face with the very lightest touch. I shuddered. Then she picked up my water and drank deeply of it, until the water had filtered through the ice, and the ice was nothing more than a fragile lattice. And then the whole construction slid against her face as she tipped the glass higher, and she chewed the slivers that landed in her mouth. "Don't waste that stomach space on water," she said, crunch, crunch, crunching. "Come on now. What are you eating?" "Oysters," I said, even though she could see the precarious pile of shells before me. She nodded. "Are they good?" she asked. "They are. Tell me about them." "They are the sum of all healthy things, seawater and muscle and bone," I said. "Mindless protein. They feel no pain, have no verifiable thoughts, very few calories. An indulgence without being an indulgence. Do you want one?" I didn't want her to be there. I wanted to tell her to leave. But her eyes were glittering as if she had a fever. She ran her fingernail lovingly along an oyster shell. The whole pile shifted, doubling down on its own mass. "Now," she said, then, "have you told Cal about the procedure?" I bit my lip. "No," I said. "Did you tell your daughter before you got it?" "I did. She was so excited for me. She sent me flowers." "Cal will not be excited," I said. "There are many daughter duties Cal does not perform, and this will be one, too." "Do you think she needs the surgery, too? Is that why?" "I don't know," I said. "I have never understood Cal's needs." "Do you think it's because she will think badly of you?" "I've also never understood her opinions," I said. My sister nodded. "She will not send me flowers," I concluded, even though this was probably not necessary. I ordered a pile of hot truffle fries, which burned the roof of my mouth. It was only after the burn that I thought about how much I'd miss it all. I started to cry, and my sister put her hand over mine. I was jealous of the oysters. They never had to think about themselves. At home, I called Cal to tell her. My jaw was so tightly clenched it popped when she answered the phone. On the other end, I could hear another woman's voice, stopped short by a finger to the lips unseen. Then a dog whined. Surgery? She repeated. Yes, I said. Jesus Christ, she said. Don't swear, I told her, even though I am not a religious woman. What? That's not even a fucking swear, she yelled. That was a fucking swear, and this, Jesus Christ, is not a swear, it's a proper name. And if there's ever a time to swear, it's when your mom tells you she's getting half of one of her most important organs cut away for no reason. She was still talking, but it was growing into a yell. I shooed the words away like bees. Occur to you that you're never going to be able to eat like a normal human. What is wrong with you? I finally asked her. Mom, I just don't understand why you can't be happy with yourself. You've never been... She kept talking. I stared at the receiver. When did my child sour? I didn't remember the process, the top-down tumble from sweetness to curdled anger. She was furious constantly. She was all accusation. She had taken the moral high ground from me by force time and time again. I had committed any number of sins. Why didn't I teach her about feminism? Why did I persist in not understanding anything? And this? This takes the cake. No, don't forgive the pun. Language is infused with food like everything else, or at least like everything else should be. She was so angry, and I was glad I couldn't read her mind. I knew her thoughts would break my heart. The line went dead. She'd hung up on me. I set the phone on the receiver and realized my sisters were watching me from the doorway, two looking sympathetic, the other smug. I turned away. Why didn't Cal understand? Her body was imperfect, but it was also fresh, pliable. She could sidestep my mistakes. She could have the release of a new start. I had no self-control. But tomorrow I would relinquish control and everything would be right again. The phone rang. Cal, calling back? But it was my niece. She was selling knife sets so she could go back to school and become a... Well, I missed that part. But she would get paid just for telling me about the knives. So I let her walk me through step by step, and I bought a cheese knife with a special cutout center. So the cheese doesn't stick to the blade, see? She said. In the operating room, I was open to the world. Not that kind of open, not yet. Everything was still sealed up inside. But I was naked, except for a faintly patterned cloth gown that didn't quite wrap around my body. Wait, I said. I laid my hand upon my hip and squeezed a little. Trembled, though I didn't know why. There was an IV, and the IV would relax me. Soon I would be very far away. Dr. Yu stared at me over her mask. Gone was the sweetness from her office. Her eyes looked transformed, icy. Did you ever read that picture book about Ping the Duck? I asked her. No, she said. Ping the Duck was always punished for being the last duck home. He'd get whacked across the back with a switch. He hated that. So he ran away. After he ran away, he met some black fishing birds with metal bands around their necks. They caught fish for their masters but could not swallow the fish whole because of the bands. When they brought fish back, they were rewarded with tiny pieces they could swallow. They were obedient because they had to be. Ping, with no band, was always last and now was lost. I don't remember how it ends. It seems like a book you should read. She adjusted her mask a little. Don't make me cut out your tongue, she said. I'm ready, I told her. The mask slipped over me, and I was on the moon. Afterward, I sleep and sleep. It's been a long time since I've been so still. I stay on the couch because stairs, The stairs are impossible. In the watery light of morning, dust motes drift through the air like plankton. I have never seen the living room so early. A new world. I drink shaking sips of clear broth, brought to me by my first sister, who, silhouetted against the window, looks like a branch stripped bare by the wind. My second sister checks in on me every so often, opening the windows a crack despite the cold. "To let some air in," she says softly. She does not say the house smells stale and like death, but I can see it in her eyes as she fans the door open and shut, and open and shut, as patiently as a mother whose child has vomited. I can see her cheekbones high and tight as cherries, and I smile at her as best I can. My third sister observes me at night, sitting on a chair near the sofa, where she glances at me from above her book, her brows tightening and loosening with concern. She talks to her daughter, who loves her without judgment, I am sure, in the kitchen, so softly I can barely hear her, but then forgets herself and laughs loudly at some joke shared between them. I wonder if my niece has sold any more knives. I am transformed, but not yet, exactly. The transformation has begun, this pain, this excruciating pain. It is part of the process, and will not end until... well, I suppose I don't know when. Will I ever be done? Transformed in the past tense? Or will I always be transforming, better and better until I die? Cal does not call. When she does, I will remind her of my favorite memory of her. When I caught her with a chemical depilatory in the bathroom in the wee hours of morning, creaming her little tan arms and legs and upper lip so the hair dissolved like snow in sunlight. I will tell her when she calls. The shift at first is imperceptible, so small as to be a trick of the imagination. But then one day I button a pair of pants and they fall to my feet. I marvel at what is beneath. A pre-Cal body. A pre-me body. It is emerging, like the lie of snow withdrawing from the truth of the landscape. My sisters finally go home. They kiss me and tell me that I look beautiful. I am finally well enough to walk along the beach. The weather has been so cold that the water is thick with ice and the waves churn creamily like soft serve. I take a photo and send it to Cal, but I know she won't respond. At home, I cook a very small chicken breast and cut it into white cubes. I count the bites, and when I reach 8, I throw the rest of the food in the garbage. I stand over the can for a long while, breathing in the salt and pepper smell of chicken, mixed in with coffee grounds and something older and closer to decay. I spray window cleaner into the garbage can, so the food cannot be retrieved. I feel a little light, but good, righteous even. Before, I would have been growling, climbing up the walls from want. But now I feel only slightly empty and fully content. That night I wake up, because something is standing over me, something small, and before I slide into being awake, I think it's my daughter, up from a nightmare, or perhaps it's morning and I've overslept. Except even as my hands exchange blanket warmth for chilled air, and it is so dark, I remember that my daughter is in her late 20s, and lives in Portland with a roommate, who is not really her roommate. And she will not tell me, and I don't know why. But something is there, darkness blotting out darkness, a person-shaped outline. It sits on the bed, and I feel the weight, the mattress springs creaking and pinging. Is it looking at me, away from me? Does it look at all? And then there is nothing, and I sit up. Alone. As I learn my new diet, my forever diet, the one that will end only when I do, something is moving in the house. At first I think it is mice, but it is larger, more autonomous. Mice in walls scurry and drop through unexpected holes, and you can hear them scrabbling in terror as they plummet behind your family portraits. But this thing occupies the hidden parts of the house with purpose, and if I drop my ear to the wallpaper, it breathes audibly. After a week of this, I try to talk to it. "Whatever you are," I say, "please come out. I want to see you." Nothing. I am not sure whether I am feeling afraid or curious or both. I call my sisters. "It might be my imagination," I explain. "But did you also hear something after? In the house, a presence?" "Yes," says my first sister. "My joy danced around my house like a child, and I danced with her. We almost broke two vases that way." "Yes," says my second sister. "My inner beauty was set free and lay around in patches of sunlight like a cat preening itself." "Yes," says my third sister. "My former shame slunk from shadow to shadow as it should have. It will go away after a while. You won't even notice, and then one day it'll be gone." After I hung up with her, I try to take a grapefruit apart with my hands, but it's an impossible task. The skin clings to the fruit, and between them is an intermediary skin, thick and impossible to separate from the meat. Eventually, I take a knife and lop off domes of rinds and cut the grapefruit into a cube before ripping it open with my fingers. It feels like I am dismantling a human heart. The fruit is delicious. Slick. I swallow 8 times, and when the 9th bite touches my lips, I pull it back and squish it in my hand as if I am crumpling an old receipt. I put the remaining half of the grapefruit in a Tupperware. I close the fridge. Even now I can hear it, behind me, above me. Too large to perceive, too small to see. When I was in my 20s, I lived in a place with bugs and had the same sense of knowing invisible things moved, coordinated, in the darkness. Even if I flipped on the kitchen light in the wee hours and saw nothing, I would just wait. Then my eyes would adjust, and I would see it. A cockroach, who instead of scuttling two-dimensionally across the yawn of a white wall, was instead perched at the lip of a cupboard, probing the air endlessly with his antennae. He desired and feared in 3 dimensions. He was less vulnerable there, and yet somehow more, I realized as I wiped his guts across the plywood. In the same way, now, the house is filled with something else. It moves, restless. It does not say words, but it breathes. I want to know it. And I don't know why. "I've done research," Cal says. The line crackles as if she is somewhere with a bad signal, so she is not calling from her house. I listen for the sound of the other woman, who is always in the background, whose name I have never learned. "Oh, you're back," I say. I am in control, for once. Her voice is clipped, but then softens. I can practically hear the therapist cooing to her. She is probably going through a list that she and the therapist created together. I feel a spasm of anger. "I am worried because," she says, and then pauses. "Because?" "Sometimes there can be all of these complications. It's done, Cal. It's been done for months. There's no point to this." "Do you hate my body, Mom?" she says. Her voice splinters in pain, as if she were about to cry. "You hated yours, clearly. But mine looks just like yours used to, so..." "Stop it. You think you're going to be happy, but this is not going to make you happy," she says. I love you, I say. Do you love every part of me? It's my turn to hang up, and then, after a moment's thought, disconnect the phone. Cal is probably calling back right now, but she won't be able to get through. I let her, when I'm ready. I wake up, because I can hear a sound like a vase breaking in reverse. Thousands of shards of ceramic whispering along hardwood toward a reassembling form. From my bedroom, it sounds like it's coming from the hallway. From the hallway, it sounds like it's coming from the stairs. Down, down. Foyer. Dining room, living room, down deeper. And then I am standing at the top of the basement steps. From below, from the dark, something shuffles. I wrap my fingers around the ball chain hanging from the naked light bulb and I pull. The thing is down there. In the light, it crumples to the cement floor, curls away from me. It looks like my daughter, as a girl. That's my first thought. It's body-shaped, prepubescent, boneless. It is 100 pounds dripping wet. And it does drip. I descend to the bottom, and up close it smells warm, like toast. It looks like the clothes stuffed with straw on someone's porch at Halloween, the vague person-shaped lump made from pillows to aid a midnight escape plan. I am afraid to step over it. I walk around it, admiring my unfamiliar face in the reflection of the water heater, even as I hear its sounds, a gasping, arrested sob. I kneel down next to it. It is a body with nothing it needs. No stomach, or bones, or mouth. Just soft indents. I crouch down and stroke its shoulder, or what I think is its shoulder. It turns and looks at me. It has no eyes, but still it looks at me. She looks at me. She is awful, but honest. She is grotesque, but she is real. I shake my head. I don't know why I wanted to meet you, I say. I should have known. She curls a little tighter. I lean down and whisper where an ear might be. You are unwanted, I say. A tremor ripples her mass. I do not know I am kicking her until I am kicking her. She has nothing, and I feel nothing, except she seems to solidify before my foot meets her. And so every kick is more satisfying than the last. I reach for a broom, and I pull a muscle, swinging back and in and back and in. And the handle breaks off in her, and I kneel down and pull soft handfuls of her body out of herself, and I throw them against the wall. And I do not know I am screaming until I stop. Finally, I find myself wishing she would fight back, but she doesn't. Instead, she sounds like she is being deflated, a hissing, defeated wheeze. I stand up and walk away. I shut the basement door. I leave her there until I can't hear her anymore. Spring has come, marking the end of winter's long contraction. Everyone is waking up. The first warm day when light cardigans are enough, the streets begin to hum. Bodies move around. Not fast, but still. Smiles. Neighbors suddenly recognizable, after a season of watching their lumpy outlines walk past in the darkness. You look wonderful, says one. Have you lost weight? Says another. I smile. I get a manicure and tap my new nails along my face to show them off. I go to Salt, which is now called the Peppercorn, and eat 3 oysters. I am a new woman. A new woman becomes best friends with her daughter. A new woman laughs with all of her teeth. A new woman does not just slough off her old self, she tosses it aside with force. Summer will come next. Summer will come and the waves will be huge, the kind of waves that feel like a challenge. If you're brave, you'll step out of the bright hot day and into the foaming roil of the water, moving toward where the waves break and might break you. If you're brave, you'll turn your body over to this water that is practically an animal, and so much larger than yourself. Sometimes, if I sit very still, I can hear her gurgling underneath the floorboards. She sleeps in my bed when I'm at the grocery store, and when I come back and slam the door loudly, there are padded footsteps above my head. I know she is around, but she never crosses my path. She leaves offerings on the coffee table, safety pins, champagne bottle corks, hard candies twisted in strawberry-patterned cellophane. She shuffles through my dirty laundry and leaves a trail of socks and bras all the way to the open window. The drawers and air are rifled through. She turns all the soup can labels forward and wipes up the constellations of dried coffee spatter on the kitchen tile. The perfume of her is caught on the linens. She is around, even when she is not around. I will see her only one more time after this. I will die the day I turn 79. I will wake up early because outside a neighbor is talking loudly to another neighbor about her roses, and because Cal is coming today with her daughter for our annual visit, and because I am a little hungry, and because a great pressure is on my chest. Even as it tightens and compresses, I will perceive what is beyond my window. A cyclist bumping over concrete, a white fox loping through underbrush, the far roll of the ocean. I will think, it is as my sisters prophesied. I will think, I miss them still. I will think, here is where I learn if it's all been worth it. The pain will be unbearable, until it isn't anymore, until it loosens, and I will feel better than I have in a long time. There will be such a stillness then, broken only by a honeybee's soft-winged stumble against the screen, and a floorboard's creak. Arms will lift me from my bed. Her arms. They will be mother-soft, like dough and moss. I will recognize the smell. I will flood with grief and shame. I will look where her eyes would be. I will open my mouth to ask, but then realize the question has answered itself. By loving me when I did not love her, by being abandoned by me, she has become immortal. She will outlive me by 100 million years, more even. She will outlive my daughter and my daughter's daughter, and the earth will teem with her and her kind, their inscrutable forms and unknowable destinies. She will touch my cheek, like I once did Cal's so long ago, and there will be no accusation in it. I will cry as she shuffles me away from myself, toward a door propped open into the salty morning. I will curl into her body, which was my body once, but I was a poor caretaker, and she was removed from my charge. I'm sorry, I will whisper into her as she walks me toward the front door. I'm sorry, I will repeat. I didn't know. The Resident. 2 months after receiving my acceptance letter to Devil's Throat, I kissed my wife goodbye. I left the city and drove north, toward the Pea Mountains, where I had attended Girl Scout camp in my youth. The letter sat beside me on the passenger seat, pinned down by my pocketbook. Nearly as thick as fabric, the paper did not flutter like lighter, cheaper stock would have. Occasionally it spasmed with the wind. The crest at the top was embossed with gold leaf, the silhouette of a hawk that had just plucked the writhing body of a fish from the water. Dear Ms. M., it said. Dear Ms. M., I murmured as I drove. The landscape changed. Soon I passed suburbs and malls, and then stretches of trees and low hills,